My name is Mubin Sheikh. I'm born and raised in Toronto, Canada. Family is from India, conservative Muslims. Basically, grew up with an identity crisis here in Canada. Muslim Indian world calling me one way, secular Western world calling me another way. Went through the school system. Eventually, I got to high school and had a house party in which I got caught. That prompted me to seek to become more religious. In the summer of 1995, I was sent to India and Pakistan. In Pakistan, I was sent to a city called Quetta. It happened to be a Taliban stronghold at the time and continued to remain so. I had a chance encounter with the Taliban at that time, and I became enamored by them. I became a supporter of them, at least abstractly, theoretically. The concept of jihad, the idea that the only way for Muslims to regain their honor and dignity is through jihad, is something that the extremists promote this idea. And so I subscribed to that idea. I kept that up really from 1995. I got married in 1998, and that kind of calmed me down a lot. But I still waffled, meaning I still had one foot in that world until the 9/11 attacks happened. And that's what prompted me to reevaluate my commitment to this ideology and why I was subscribing to this ideology. I would then spend 2 years in Syria studying Arabic and Islamic studies and realized that the extremist interpretations were completely contrary to Islam. In 2004, I returned back to Canada and I was recruited by the Canadian Security Intelligence Service to conduct various infiltration operations online and on the ground. In 2006, a case that I had been working on was sent over to the Federal Police Services. 18 individuals were arrested in that case. There were legal hearings, five legal hearings held over 4 years. 11 individuals were ultimately convicted or pled guilty. In 2010, the case was done. I got onto social media, Facebook and Twitter mostly. The war in Syria started in 2011. By 2012, we started to see the rise of what would later come to be ISIS. In 2014, ISIS declared its so-called caliphate, and that's when the attacks by ISIS first started. So from 2012 to 2018, I assisted the US military in various anti-ISIS operations. And I joined Parents for Peace actually in 2016 when the discussion on ISIS returnees was at its peak, I think, or it was just beginning, you could say. And so since then, I've been engaged with Parents for Peace, working on extremism related cases, working on intervening with extremist or otherwise radicalized individuals, some of whom have been or were arrested, and some of whom who were not arrested. Those who, remain in some kind of custodial setting. So they may be in prison awaiting their trial, or they have served a sentence, or they're about to serve a sentence. We at Parents for Peace look at the problem of extremism across the ideological spectrum. We deal with people who are so-called Islamists, white supremacists, leftist extremists. There is such a thing. And we cover that entire spectrum. Most of our work is in the US, of course, and we work with the families, we work with the individuals, we work with their lawyers where we're relevant. And happy to say I'm very proud to work with this with such an organization doing the work that we do.
Could you tell me a little bit about identity and its role in extremism? Take us back to that house party. What exactly happened there that made you question your identity and start following extremist groups?
Conflicts over meaning and identity are very common in the human experience. This is something that, of course, transcends nationality, religion, gender. It is a core human thing. And human beings want to feel that they've defined themselves, in such a way that they understand who they are, they understand what is required of them, they understand what they need to do. And the identity crisis is where all of those things are in question, are in flux, are not yet solidified. And this is quite normal, of course, for teenagers in particular. Teenagers just practicing to become an adult. And so the identity crisis that hit me was the result of a first generation Canadian Muslim navigating that space in which there are different things pulling at them. For me, I could say there was a cultural Indian component. I can say there was also a religious component. And so trying to figure out which of those hats I'm supposed to wear is what created that identity crisis. And it's the same thing at navigation, that multiple hat situation. This is something that applies to anybody and everybody. And so that's generally how identity just exists in the larger equation. I noticed that the identity crisis is easily the most common factor when it comes to radicalization of people, in a Western context. And I note a Western context because of, think about what this Western experiment is. It's bringing together people of all different backgrounds and just throwing them together in, in the same area, and basically all trying to get along, everyone trying to be on relatively the same page. And how possible can that be when you have all these different ideas, beliefs, cultural communities that you have to basically navigate between? That was my life in at least the beginning part of my teenage years, just trying to figure everything out. So in high school, when, I see myself as a member of this social group, it's comprised of people from all different backgrounds, right? You have, white Western European, there are Asians, but the other Asians, I knew, Black Canadians. It was very diverse. It was a very, diverse background. And that's just the, I think, testament to how Canada is and, the multicultural context in which we operate. So it's within that environment of seeking out new friendships, succumbing to the cultural temptations of others, that this identity crisis is happening. And it's learning from them and hanging out with them what exactly a house party is, right? And that was basically just, invite people to the house while my parents were gone. Hopefully, nobody will notice, obviously, the big mess that's been left inside. And so what happened was my father realized that somebody, should check on the house while he was gone. And so, unbeknownst to me, he had told his brother to visit the house, to check the house while he was gone. And so, of course, in the middle of the party that I had, my uncle burst through the door and obviously became very upset and very angry at what he had, chanced upon, I guess, and what he was looking at. And so that's what triggered my descent into radicalization. This in radicalization theory is what we call a cognitive opening, something that happens to a person that is so shocking to their system that they will open up to views that they would normally not be open to. So that cognitive opening is what then oriented me towards the idea of becoming religious as a solution to my newly discovered problem.
Would you say it was some sort of like a eureka moment that made you feel like you instantly belonged to the extremist groups?
Yeah, I think the time that I was in high school living that life with all my friends, I did belong. I was not bullied, I wasn't picked on, I wasn't the victim of racism. We became the cool kids of school. And so that was definitely something that I enjoyed very much, and which culminated, of course, in having that house party. But then getting caught and getting publicly humiliated like that, as far as I was concerned anyway. I mean, the students loved it. I mean, it was a party that they talked about for a long, long time. Mubin's uncle came in and everyone took off and diving out of the windows, and but it did force me to almost decide and have to make a decision. It was either I was going to be religious and, salvage my reputation with my family or not. And I think the pull towards the family and the community was so much stronger, through, I guess, shame and guilt. It got me to a place where I realized I just need to dive into this religious identity, and that will restore my reputation and credibility with my family and my community.
Mubin, let's talk a little bit about your time in Pakistan. What were the sort of conversations you were having with people that made you feel like you belonged? What were the sort of tactics they were using to make you feel like you'd found maybe a pathway that you want to pursue?
I think it was less, there, because the group that I went with, the Tabligh Jamaat, as they're called, although they are, you could say, fundamentalist, they are apolitical, which is very uncommon. A lot of the, well, we see fundamentalist religious groups, they tend to be political and politically oriented. But the Tabligh Jamaat are not politically oriented. Right, they're odd in this case, and they do stand apart from everyone else. So it's not that they had specific narratives or statements or anything like that, which would which deliberately worked on a person's sense of belonging. But what they did was, through their actions, they made us feel like we belonged in that. Because at that stage, the 4 month thing was really like an immersion experience. You would spend 2 months in India, and 2 months in Pakistan. You would go from, mosque to mosque. You were very independent, so you had your own money. The group didn't ask for money. We didn't collect money. We didn't beg for money. What it does is it gives you the opportunity to become that religiously observant person that you should be, basically, by staying in the mosque, by engaging in these religious activities, which only revolve around prayer and fasting and reading Quran and serving other people. And these sorts of things made it very easy, in that sense. So you would just basically engage in the practice of the religion and basically become used to it, condition yourself to doing so, getting up in the morning, and then throughout the day, ultimately five different prayers, lectures, more prayers, right? This was something that you could replicate to a point where this could become your daily life. And it did.
When did you realize that you were getting radicalized? Did somebody tell you, or was it when friends or family began isolating you?
So interestingly, the Tabligh Jamaat, like I said, they're apolitical. They do not talk about politics, and they actually do not like it when people talk about politics. And so very quickly, I realized that this was not the group for me. And I actually left the Tabligh Jamaat and started hanging out with a more extremist type of people. So we can say the category would be Salafi like Takfiri. So Salafi Takfiri is like the Salafist is basically a very politicized fundamentalist, worldview. The basics of Salafism is the claim that one must return to the original way of Islam that was practiced by the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the early generations, the Salaf, what's called the Salaf. And attached to that was the politicization of the religion. Everything was couched in political terms. Everything was viewed from the prism of politics, of religious politics, of the idea that Islam is not just a religion, but it is a, this was the belief that it was also a political ideology, that it needed to be implemented in every aspect of someone's life, and by force if necessary. And this is when I became more attuned to the conflicts that were happening in the world, and started to filter everything through that paradigm of this notion that being in a state of constant conflict is how one should live. And so the idea was kind of solidified in my mind that fighting and waging war against the enemies of Islam and Muslims is the only way forward. And I knew that this was extreme, even at that time. I knew that most people don't think like this. Most people don't do this sort of stuff. And so I knew that I was becoming extreme. Although people from my previous associations also reminded me that, the road that I was going down, was going to lead to something very, very bad if I wasn't careful. And so people and friends and family, and they all started to see my radicalization. They could all see where I was going with this, and it wasn't looking good.
You went through this experience before 9/11 happened in the US, right? And how did that act of terrorism then influence you?
No, so I got married, like I said, it calmed me down a little bit, but while I was in Canada, of course, that's when 9/11 happened. And after that, so it happened in September. In April, I would leave Canada to go to live in Syria for 2 years.
And that was like your de-radicalization process?
That's right. I spent 2 years studying Arabic and Islamic studies. I, went through the entire Quran. We learned, of course, about the because there are two primary sources of Islam, and they are the Quran and the Sunnah. The Sunnah is the demonstrated example and the sayings and tacit approvals of the Prophet, peace be upon him. And there was a whole methodology that is employed in understanding Islam. There's the Quran and Sunnah, and then it goes into, biographical material. And that's where you get most of the war stories that extremists, fixate on. And as I was reminded, there was a very, very small portion of time in which Muslims were engaged in fighting. for the first 10 of the 23 years that the Prophet, peace be upon him, was with the community, there was nothing. And even in the subsequent years after that, a very small amount of time over the 23 years, or in the complete period, a very small portion was spent in fighting. And then you also learn that in what is called sirah and maghazi material, these are reports that are not as authentic and accurate as what we might find in the hadith, which are basically like raw intelligence reports that have been associated degrees of reliability. So I find that a lot of the things that the extremists talked about really came out of things that were not authentic. And in fact, when you looked at the interpretations of the verses, the context of the verses, translation, etc., their interpretations were completely wrong. They had been falsified in some cases, meaning they will say that it says this, but in fact, it doesn't say that. So spending 2 years there in a very deep dive study of the Islamic sources, this is when I would go through what I later learned was this thing called de-radicalization.
That's super interesting. You got into that group wanting to learn more about the religion and then also use religion to de-radicalize yourself. Is this a sort of solution that you use now when you help other people who have undergone or are experiencing a similar experience like you?
Every person's journey is unique, and I do use this particular approach in my life. This is what it took for me, and I have used this, in the time since with people that I've dealt with. I do use that Islamic approach. Sometimes, for some people, they go off track. Meaning you might find, as I found, sometimes you have a former Muslim extremist and they've become either agnostic or they've become atheist altogether. Sometimes this happens. It's not as common. But what is more common is indeed using the religion, to basically counter the interpretations of religious extremists. And I also did this in my time countering ISIS online from 2012. I had an extensive internet footprint, if you will, or online presence between the years of 2012 and 2018, inclusive in that period. And I, every single day, I was engaging with ISIS members multiple times a day. Multiple individuals at the same time. And I was using the religion. I was using religious sources. And this is one of the things that I found is that these people, they claim to be authority on the religion. But in fact, many of them don't know the religion. And when you challenge them and when you kind of go back and forth with them, once they come to realize that, then that's the wedge, then that's the opening that you can create inside somebody to realize, hold on a second, is it possible that I don't actually know the Islam that I follow in the way that I claim that I know it? And that is what we hope to achieve, to create that sense of seeking more knowledge and more information in a person's mind so that they would reconsider this extremist, opinion that they've subscribed to at that time.
I also wanted to know, besides those who get radicalized because of religious reasons, these days there's a lot of socio-political forms of extremism as well. I mean, in the US, we're seeing that now and also in other countries. So then, how do you handle it when it's a socio-political event that makes someone get into extremist groups or believe in extremist views?
what you can do in this context now is you can, even with my story, you can strip away all the religious stuff from it, and you can break it, you know, we can bring it, if you will, to its component parts. So social, political, you know, the different manifestations of radicalization that we see in North America today, a lot of it has to do with the same things that you would find somebody radicalizing into a religious group, right? Ideas of identity. Identity is a big thing, okay? Quest for significance. You know, we all want to be somebody. We all want to be viewed by others as being somebody and having this worth. These are all factors that will apply even, you know, in these cases. You also see, for example, the group dynamics. So when people join with protest movements or, you know, certain closed circle of friends, you know, these are things that will facilitate that radicalization process. It doesn't matter what your background is or what you're, where you're coming from or what ideology you end up in. So you have, you know, a sense of identity, identity conflicts, quest for significance, deprivation and frustration. Okay, so somebody feels that, you know, an election was stolen from them, for example. You know, this is how some of these things manifest. Even a sense of adventure for some people. Sometimes there are factors that are activated in a person that, you know, that don't have anything to do with ideas per se, or political ideas or religious ideas or whatever. There is a confluence of factors, you know, for radicalization to. There's a wonderful quote that goes, "Ideology without grievances doesn't resonate, and grievances without ideology are not acted upon." So again, ideology without grievances doesn't resonate, and grievances without ideology are not acted upon. So that's kind of shows you the interplay between those two factors, ideology and grievances. So you can look at some or all of these factors, or you should look at, you know, all of these factors, and then we can identify in this particular context when we see radicalization occurring, why it's occurring. And keep in mind, radicalization is not necessarily and automatically and inherently a bad thing. It is certainly not something that automatically leads to violence. You know, radicalization is basically the psychological process whereby people become increasingly extreme in their views. Okay. It's a process. The end states of radicalization are basically two. Extremism, where a person comes to believe, you know, that violence in the public space is okay. They believe it in theory. And the other end state is violent extremism, where they actually do the violence and bring it, you know, and manifest it into the physical space. So the vast majority of radicalized people, even those who are extremist, will not become violent. It's difficult to know which of, let's say, a group of 10 extremists, which two are going to become violent. And in some cases, you can't know. You have to monitor all 10 and hope to catch the two that, you know, that become violent. So in the current context of this increased polarization, and that's another factor of radicalization in society. When you look at what's happening and these different push and pull factors, so, you know, push factors are societal factors, you know, could relate to government efficacy or, you know, larger societal issues, maybe even social status or socioeconomic status, sorry. And then you have pull factors, which are things within an individual. That pull them into a group, or which a group can pull an individual into their orbit by. So by giving them a sense of belonging, by giving them a sense of, you're part of a greater purpose, right? By giving them a sense of you are unique, you are unlike others, you know, you stepped up, others have not stepped up. This sort of reinforcement and confirmation to an individual, all of these things taken together is what animates that radicalization process that we see, you know, in every context today.
It's really interesting that you touched upon the fact of not stripping extremists of their agency. But in society, as soon as you start seeing somebody is getting radicalized or is an extremist, people instantly isolate them. For example, they categorize them under labels like dangerous people, threat to society. And is this how people should be reacting to a case where, you know, maybe their loved one or somebody they know of in their neighborhood is going through this radicalization process? And do you think the government policies should play a role here?
So this is you know, this is something that Parents for Peace is you know, very well involved in. And one way to understand this is kind of break it down into its levels, right? You have the individual at their level, and then you have or it's almost like a ring model, right? Like you have the person at the center, okay? And you know, I did say that radicalization is not necessarily inherently and automatically something bad or violent or whatever. And the reason why it's kind of become you know, to be seen in that way is because of those cases where a radicalized person becomes violent. That's usually, unfortunately, when, you know, everybody else comes to realize it too. You know, they'll end up doing something, you know, horrific in the community or wherever. And then of course by then it's too late, right? So where can we and how can we interdict that process? So at that place where is first to identify where the how the radicalization is occurring. So a person is, you know, increasingly extreme, becoming more and more extreme in their views. If family members can see that, and or others, it could be friends, it could be a teacher in school, it could be a colleague at work. The first thing to do is not to isolate that person and not to completely cut them off, even if they might cut you off. It does happen. But to remain in their orbit and influence as much and as long as possible, and to engage them with personal stories and personal things, especially for those with whom you've had a friendship for so long, and to keep working on that friendship or whatever that the nature of that relationship is, condemning them, pointing fingers at them, damning them to hell. These are not tactics that work. Having a strong support system around that person is going to be very necessary. Reminding them of the positive experiences and the positive relationships that they've had with themselves and with others. Parents becoming aware of what their kids might be viewing online. Maybe looking at some of the logos or symbols of certain groups that they might be portraying. Sometimes it's really obvious, you know, when your kid has a swastika flag in their room or an ISIS flag or, you know, the Black Sun or, you know, understanding what the hate symbols are or logos and you know, symbols of these sorts of groups is necessary for parents nowadays, especially where they see their child becomes more withdrawn, they start cutting people off, they start cutting off certain kinds of friends, they make it very clear what their new ideology is. Sometimes they do make it clear, other times it's just kept to themselves and they're internalizing everything, and you might need to do a little bit more probing. So these are this is what happens, in these cases. And for parents especially who are listening, it's a very difficult time because your parents are working. I mean, it's there, you don't have so much time available. And most of that time, those kids are basically being conditioned by other friends. Some of those friends you can see, and other those friends you can't see. So for parents in particular, to be aware of what's happening and to be involved in their children's lives. And look, if there are problems at home for whatever reasons, then seek help. I know it's easy to say, but it's really hard to do for some people. And all I can say is that seeing a lot of cases where people did not seek out the help and things turned out really, really badly for the family. It turned out much, much worse than, had they gone to some kind of family therapy or even religious, fellowship or counseling or, something along those lines. So again, I use it as a ring model. You have the individual at the center, you have, their parents or their family or their friends. Then you can work outwards into the society and institutions and what are the roles that institutions have, like schools, for example, or what is going to be necessary is to take this public health approach to extremism, where you bring to bear the largest support network you can think of, starting from the individual, their immediate people, and then, like I said, to the institutions, schools, etc. One, we have to understand that once the police get involved, it's pretty much too late. Meaning, not that there's no hope left for the person or whatever, but it's too late, meaning that the mandate of a police organization is, of course, to investigate crimes and to prosecute and then to provide the evidence for the prosecution of those crimes. And that's what, leads us to prison institutions. And we talked about a little bit of what Parents for Peace does in that context as well. But we encourage, people to interdict that process before it gets to the police and before the police become even be, before the police become aware of it. Sometimes we've dealt with cases where the FBI has showed up at someone's house, knocking on their door saying, "Hey, listen, we know what your 14-year-old kid is doing. Knock it off. Otherwise, we're going to be here and you're going to be going to prison." So there are many places in which this can be interdicted. We just need to ask ourselves, and your listeners should ask themselves, where do I sit on that spectrum? Or where do I sit on that ring model? Let's call it that. Am I a parent? Am I an extended relative? Am I an employer? Am I an educator? Am I a health professional? Am I a sports professional? Whatever role you have and whatever function, you have, there is an influence that you can bring to bear on an individual who has gone down the wrong path. And engaging with that person with compassion, with kindness, with understanding. Believe me, it's been difficult for me too. It's been a learning process, but in the end, we'll all be better for it. And that's what I encourage everyone to do. So you can look into, if I can just give a plug in for parents, for the number 4peace.org is the website. Parents, the number 4peace.org. You can check us out and see what we do. And there are other organizations in the US, a few other organizations that do relatively similar work as well. Just reach out to somebody and reach out and get the help that you need and that we all need, society needs, I think, at this time.
After former extremists get the help they need to get de-radicalized, is there a fear that they could go back to joining extremist groups again? What sort of tools or techniques could help them navigate potential radicalization triggers?
Building that resiliency in an individual and in the support network that is serving that individual. So, it is, and the thing is, like, as a person, kind of, because there are going to be triggers, there's going to be, some form of relapse, if I can use that term. It does happen. A person, especially young people, when they're still trying to form that identity, and trying to do so with a still developing and still forming brain, even, it's not uncommon that that will happen. And so building resiliency, and what that means is preparing an individual for triggers that will come up, and possibly try to suck them back into that understanding. So preparing an individual at the outset is going to be the most important aspect of that resiliency. Secondly, is going to be, how do you deal with that once it occurs? If an idea comes up again, well, there are ways in which that can be dealt with. If it's a certain ideology, if it's an intellectual thing, well, then it can be discussed intellectually, right? If it's something that's, related to a physical condition, well, then we can go, to a physician or some medical professional or other kind of professional to maybe deal with that part of, the situation. Having a support system around a person is what's going to carry them through that moment of re potential relapse or actual relapse.
Lastly, when a person is going through a de-radicalization process, the local or national governments and the justice system is also involved. Is there a way for them to address and approach such cases?
I think what needs to be incorporated more so in the justice system in North America, and primarily in the US, there's at some level there is, some of this happening in Canada. We can look at other countries in other parts of the world, that to get a hold of these individuals as early as possible. So, somebody gets arrested, and then that's it. They just become clients of the justice system, and pretty much there's no programming available to them, directed, extremism engagement type programs. Unfortunately, it's, that person is just then left to imprisonment, and that's it. And so I would strongly encourage, especially lawyers, who are dealing with these sorts of cases, because we do have experience, working with lawyers when an individual has been arrested, and they may be waiting for their trial. Even if it goes to trial, there will be several months in that meantime. And we feel at Parents for Peace, we feel that this is the most important time to engage these individuals, and get them that intervention that they need and that is required, and then produce a report for the court to explain to the judge, this is what happened in this person's life. This is the intervention program that we employed in this case, and basically give an assessment of whether that intervention was useful or not. And this is something that will set up that individual for future success, because I don't think that we can just leave them, and just leave them to a prison term and that's it. We don't want to. We want to interdict. We want to prevent any kind of extremism developing in prison, and even further radicalizing an individual. And so to prevent all of that is why I encourage, these court systems, to start looking into these specialized interventions.